Whether it's slots or live dealers, SpinQuest.com has the fun and action you're looking for with SpinQuest exclusives, blackjack, roulette, baccarat, and even live dice with craps and bubble craps. The games never stop, so you don't have to. And right now, new users get $30 coin packs for just 10 bucks. Play now at SpinQuest.com.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
I've never seen a city so overtaken with panic in my entire career.
This is the story of a serial killer whose crimes are so calculated, so theatrical, they would echo far beyond one campus and inspire an entire horror franchise.
It was palpable, the fear that was going through the student body.
In 1990, Danny Rowling committed a series of 5 murders over the course of one weekend. The crimes shattered the University of Florida, locked down Gainesville, and sent a wave of fear across the country. 6 years later, elements of those killings would resurface in the horror franchise Scream. But the reality was far more disturbing.
I mean, as 18 years old, you freak out and think, what is going on? And it was very scary.
I spent a significant amount of time in Gainesville speaking with reporters, authors, and students who lived through those days. People who remember the sound of helicopters overhead, the rumors spreading through dorms, and the creeping realization that this wasn't random.
You hadn't heard anything like that since like Ted Bundy, at least in our area.
This isn't just about what the Gainesville Ripper did in Florida. It's about what was already happening long before Gainesville. And by the end of this episode, you'll understand exactly where it began and why no one stopped it. I'm James Buddy Day. This is Unmarked. Florida isn't just palm trees and postcards. It's a peninsula. 3 sides water, 1 long highway in and out. A transient state, tourism, college towns, seasonal residents, people arriving, people leaving. And historically, it's been a place where violent offenders surface. Or perhaps I should say, resurface. Ted Bundy ended his run here. Eileen Wuornos operated along its highways. Florida isn't the cause, but it's often the convergence point. And in the case of the Gainesville Ripper, the people who lived through it are still there.
I was doing daily stories about the murders at that point. So that's where my focus was, on the murders and who was doing this. And then the panic on the University of Florida campus.
That's Mike Deason, an Emmy-winning investigative journalist who I spoke with at his home in Tampa.
I've never seen a city so overtaken with panic in my entire career.
Before we go deeper, here are the basics. Danny Rowling was a Louisiana native, a drifter who ended up in South Florida. And in August of 1990, over a single weekend, he committed 5 murders that would define the case and earn him the name the Gainesville Ripper. These crimes were violent. They were public. Coverage spread across the state and then the country. In fact, a screenwriter named Kevin Williamson watched the panic unfold. And years later, elements of that fear would reappear in the horror film he wrote called Scary Movie, which became the franchise Scream. But what happened in Gainesville wasn't cinematic. It was procedural and preventable.
The entire state became focused on what is going on in Gainesville. Who's this monster?
In the case of Danny Rowling, it's difficult to comprehend the level of trauma, physical and psychological, that precedes the murders. To understand him, we have to go back, long before Gainesville, before he's even born. Rowling's family history is marked by violence and severe mental instability. His great-grandfather murdered his great-grandmother in their home, an act witnessed by Danny's father, James Rowling.
Danny's father, James, his grandfather, I think, killed his wife at like the kitchen table. I basically slit her throat. Right in front of James. He saw it.
That's the voice of J.T. Hunter, author of A Monster of All Time, the true story of Danny Rowling, the Gainesville Ripper. It's one of the most detailed examinations of the case.
I know there were other people in his family. His uncle, I know, committed suicide. His mother had schizophrenia. James, by all indications, definitely had mental health issues himself.
There's no clean way to measure heredity, not yet. But it's reasonable to say Danny Rowling likely inherited a predisposition toward mental illness and volatility. What we can say with certainty is that whatever vulnerability existed was compounded, repeatedly, inside his own home.
He had a rough childhood, as I recall. Remember, this is a long time ago. The murders were 1990. But he had a very rough childhood. And was an unusual kid, as I recall. Didn't get along well with his father.
James Rowling is central to understanding the crimes his son would go on to commit. A Korean War veteran, James Rowling marries Danny's mother, Claudia, when she's 19. Neighbors described him as erratic and cruel. At trial, one witness describes the Rowling household as, quote, chaotic and unstable, where physical and emotional abuse were daily occurrences. Claudia is beaten while pregnant, strangled, and in one instance, James shoves her down a flight of stairs while she's carrying Danny. What that level of stress does to a developing brain is still debated. Nonetheless, Danny Rowling is born on May 26th, 1954. A younger brother follows 15 months later. In the early days, the family moves frequently through Georgia and Louisiana before settling in Shreveport when Danny is only 6 years old. There, James Rowling becomes a police officer. And this is crucial because the man responsible for the abuse isn't just a violent father. He is law enforcement, and this is a message his son receives loud and clear.
James was a cop there at the Pine, and you know, knowing how kind of a brotherhood that cops have to begin with, you know, they tend to look out for each other, they tend to kind of protect one another. So, you know, it's certainly very feasible that he, you know, kind of got away with some things.
At the time, the Shreveport Police Department is plagued by allegations of corruption and mismanagement. Police Chief George D'Artois would later be accused of running the department like a personal empire, shaking down businesses, associating with organized crime. By the time Danny and his brother can walk, their father is already punishing them. Belts, ropes, hours of forced stress positions. The infractions are minor, talking back, bad grades, spilling something at the dinner table, wearing blue jeans to church. Reports are made to Shreveport police, but documentation later describes the situation as, quote, a family matter, with police notes indicating that James Rowling is, quote, a good officer. It's a systematic failure that will cost lives for decades to come.
You kind of put yourself in a position as a young boy growing up, and you know, like all young boys, you learn to admire your father, you know, and you want approval, and to have that deliberately withheld and to go through all the horrible things that went through with your father growing up.
Neighbors press the issue to Police Chief George D'Artois. Nothing changes. The system that could intervene protects its own. Witnesses later say James appears to take satisfaction in the abuse. Danny's mother leaves the home repeatedly, 24 times over the course of the marriage, but she always, always returns. Each time she leaves, the boys remain behind. Danny grows up in a constant state of fear.
Yeah, like he was abandoned as a child by his mother, basically, because she never interceded, protected him.
As a child, Danny Rowling is so anxious, he injures himself compulsively. scratching at his skin, picking at his fingers, unable to regulate the stress response that never shuts off. To cope, he begins peeping into windows, and this is key. He's watching other families through the glass. Later, he will describe imagining himself inside those homes, not as an intruder, not at first. At first, it's about being a member of the family. This is a key moment in understanding Rowling. Research on psychopathy and severe antisocial behavior suggests that in some individuals, early trauma disrupts identity formation. The sense of self becomes fractured. Shame and rage begin to coexist when control feels absent. That's when fantasy steps in. The internal world becomes more vivid than the external one. Depression deepens, substance use increases.
With her stranger to bars and drinking, and it certainly seemed like he drank quite a bit. I don't know if he was, stumbling around alcoholic level, but he definitely drank a lot. And I believe he drank before he committed RPD murder.
At 14, Danny comes home with alcohol on his breath. His father beats him, handcuffs him to a chair, and he calls his fellow officers. When the police arrive, they arrest Danny, and they place him in juvenile detention. From his perspective, once again, authority does not protect him. It punishes him. Not long after, his mother leaves again, this time hospitalized for severe mental illness. Danny attempts to escape by joining the Air Force, but he's discharged within the year. Rowling is now 19, a high school dropout with no prospects, when he meets a woman named O'Mather Loomis. It's shortly after he joins a Pentecostal church. Surprisingly, they marry on September 6th, 1974. And they have a daughter. And for a brief period, the only stable stretch of his life, Rowling appears functional. But trauma doesn't disappear just because circumstances temporarily improve. The marriage begins to deteriorate almost immediately. Rowling starts disappearing at night with no explanation.
Emotionally, he's still stuck to act as almost a child. And he has this anger, this resentment, this rage by the way he was treated from his father, but then also towards his mother as well.
Rowling gets drunk and peeps into windows. And he's seen. At one point, police question him. They even interview his wife at his home, but fail to intervene once again. And one evening, during an argument, Danny Rowling holds a shotgun to his wife's head and threatens to kill her. She takes their baby and leaves. Neither see him again until he's arrested a decade later. Spiraling, Danny Rowling attempts to rob a Winn-Dixie with an unloaded gun. Psychologists later describe the robbery as reckless, possibly an unconscious attempt to provoke a lethal response. He serves time and is released in 1982, and he moves back in with his parents, where the abuse resumes. So, in July of 1985, Danny Rowling walks into a Kroger in Jackson, Mississippi, pulls a gun at the checkout and demands money. He leaves with just $290 and is caught the next day. Like before, the crime is impulsive and sloppy. But it's this robbery that changes things, because Rowling is sentenced to 5 years in prison, where he struggles mightily with incarceration. He later claims it was the cause of his subsequent murder spree. But this type of justification is not unusual for individuals with severe antisocial traits.
Prison was no joke. It was a pretty harsh prison. It is known to be that way. So I suspect, it was certainly was no, cakewalk for him there. So he probably had some pretty bad conditions when he was there. Was it to the extent he said? Maybe not.
While incarcerated, a psychiatrist evaluates him. The assessment lists multiple personality disorders, substance abuse, and paraphilia, specifically voyeurism. Though it's worth noting that the diagnostic criteria in the 1980s was much different than it is today. Labels shift, terminology evolves, but what doesn't change is behavior. By this point, Rowling's peeping is no longer occasional, it's compulsive. He admits to spending 2 or 3 hours a night looking into windows, sometimes for sexual arousal. And that connects to a larger pattern. Children raised in constant threat learn to live inside their own heads, hypervigilant, preoccupied, reinforcing fantasy through early stalking behavior. And when control feels absent, fantasy becomes reality. The internal world grows stronger than the external one. Over time, watching is not enough. This comes to a head in 1989. Rowling is released from prison, and on November 4th, he's living in Shreveport, Louisiana, where he's fired from yet another menial job.
It was literally the same day that he was fired from a job he'd been working at. And he was fired for grounds that he thought were unfair. You know, he thought he was getting basically picked on or something and was unfairly terminated. So it brought out the rage in him. You know, he already had this anger that was kind of like constantly simmering.
He wanders his neighborhood. He's agitated, aimless. That's when he sees Julie Grissom, 24 years old, a college student at Louisiana State University, Shreveport. As he has dozens of times before, he follows her. Investigators later estimate Rowling enters the Grissom home sometime between 6 and 8 p.m. There are no signs of forced entry, no ransacking, no robbery. This is not opportunistic theft. It's targeted. Once inside the home, he attacks Julie's father, William Tom Grissom, who'd been outside grilling. Rowling kills him. He also murders Julie's young nephew, a third grader visiting for the weekend. Finally, he finds Julie in her bedroom. Evidence later shows he remains inside the home after the murders. The scene is staged. Julie Grissom's body is posed. This is no longer voyeurism or anything like it. This is domination.
You kind of go back and trace his behavior, his girl behavior. Yeah, he started out peeping in windows, watching you win and undress, things like that. And then he eventually got in through robberies, armed robberies and rapes, and then escalated to murder.
Afterwards, Rowling drives home. It's 10 minutes away. The proximity is predictable. Serial offenders frequently operate within comfort zones. Familiar streets, known escape routes, predictable terrain. But despite the brutality and the amount of physical evidence left inside the home, police make no immediate arrest. Rowling watches the coverage, and something shifts.
They're using all their police resources to try to solve this murder, and he slipped through the cracks.
Criminologists describe a phenomenon that often follows a first successful murder. It's called perceived omnipotence. When there are no immediate consequences, the offender's fear diminishes. Control expands, the fantasy becomes reinforced. For Rowling, this manifests at home, where for the first time he stands up to his father. In May 1990, an argument inside the Rowling house escalates into gunfire. Accounts differ about who fired first, but what is undisputed is that Danny retrieves a pistol and shoots his father in the head. At that point, Rowling believes he's killed him. He hasn't. James Rowling survives, and Danny leaves.
I'm here with SpinQuest, where you can play and win from the comfort of your own home with hundreds of slot games and all of the table games you love with real cash prizes. Right now, $30 coin packs are on sale for $10 for new users. It's all at SpinQuest.com. That's SpinQuest.com.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
6 miles away, Danny breaks into another home and holds a couple at gunpoint. forcing them to call the hospital to confirm whether his father is dead or alive. When he learns his father survived, he thanks the couple, accepts a coat, $21, an apple, some cookies, and he walks out. He abandons his car at a Motel 6 around the corner and boards a Greyhound bus. Records show Danny Rowling checking into a travel lodge in Tallahassee under the name Michael Kennedy.
Ironically enough, I guess, you know, he ended up in Tallahassee, where Bundy did some of his notorious killings. That's where he ended up hurt, got off the bus there very quickly. And that's where he actually purchased the knife, the end of it, if you've been to kill the students in Dingville.
Throughout August of 1990, he moves across Florida, staying in motels, sleeping outside, circling apartment complexes. On August 5th in Sarasota, he breaks into the home of Jeanette Frake. He restrains her and sexually assaults her, but doesn't kill her. 2 weeks later, on August 18th, he checks into the University Inn in Gainesville, still using the name Michael Kennedy. This again is investigative reporter Mike Deason.
Gainesville's an idyllic college town. It is it's a beautiful city. It's the college campus that you would see in a movie with ivy on some of the buildings. And the town just revolves around the university. Most of the people that live there are associated in some way or another, either as professors or they've got friends that work at the university. It dominates the town.
You have to picture Rowling at this point. He doesn't look dangerous. He's quiet, withdrawn, slight, 5'9". He's only about 160 pounds, not physically imposing. He does not stand out. In a transient state like Florida, hitchhikers, drifters, students, seasonal workers, he looks just like another man passing through. 5 days later, on August 23rd, he checks out of the motel. He purchases a screwdriver and camping supplies from a Walmart. He sets a campsite nearby.
He was acting like a hunter. So he was on a camping trip, and he was camping, and then he was hunting his victims. And then he would go to the campsite again afterwards. That was my take on why he was camping in the woods.
On Friday, August 24th, 1990, the Florida Gators are preparing to open the season the following weekend. Students are moving into the dorms for the fall semester. This is Laura Azzarello Thompson, who is 18 years old at the time, a freshman at the University of Florida.
I heard good things about the academic program. I was pretty motivated to succeed academically, and I applied to several universities, and I was fortunate enough to get a Florida academic scholarship. So I can't tell you there was any one specific thing that led me to University of Florida, but it was 2 hours from home, but not home. Good academics, so that's why I decided to go there.
Laura's experience reflects that of thousands of students settling into campus that weekend. That night, around 3 a.m., Rowling enters the apartment of Christina Powell and Sonia Larson in a small complex near the university. Sonia Larson is studying to become a teacher. Christina Powell is studying law enforcement. Neither have any connection to Danny Rowling whatsoever. In the early morning hours of August 24th, Rowling enters their apartment through the rear dining room door. The door is locked, but it's the only entrance not reinforced with both deadbolt and chain. The frame is slightly warped, allowing him to force it open. Powell is asleep downstairs on the couch. Rowling stands over her briefly, then he goes upstairs. He enters Larson's bedroom and attacks her in bed. The medical examiner will later describe the injuries as consistent with a rapid, overwhelming assault, the kind designed to incapacitate almost immediately. The report notes that Larson likely loses consciousness very quickly. After she's killed, there's evidence her body is moved. Blood patterns indicate post-mortem repositioning. Rowling then returns downstairs. Powell is awakened, restrained, and sexually assaulted before being led into the living room and killed. When it's over, he doesn't leave immediately. He remains inside the apartment. He wipes down parts of the scene. Clothing is scattered. Objects are moved deliberately. The apartment itself is altered. He goes into the kitchen and eats fruit. The brutality is shocking, but what is equally disturbing is the order. This is not frenzy, it is control. Later, Rowling will claim that during this period, he is psychotic, that he believes himself to be possessed by a demon called Gemini.
He saw himself more as kind of a victim of what had happened to him. And, you know, he basically a nice guy deep down and all these book of things. So I think he invented that afterwards as a way to distance himself from the things he had done.
We need to be precise here. Psychosis involves a break from reality. We're talking about hallucinations, delusions, disorganized thinking. But what we see in the Powell and Larson apartment is structured behavior. Entry, isolation, control, staging. That does not resemble a mind in chaos. Some offenders construct narratives of madness after the fact, but true psychosis destabilizes planning. It fragments behavior, but Rowling's actions here are sequential and deliberate. The next night, on October 25th, 1990, Rowling returns to the home of Krista Hoyt, an 18-year-old chemistry honors student at Santa Fe College whom he'd been watching for days. Once again, this is not psychosis. This is premeditated and carefully planned. This is Melissa Rancourt, a Florida-based journalist who attended a nearby school at the time.
It just shows that he's a sick bastard. I mean, or was, you know, I mean, unfortunately, that it's not just, okay, I got my thrill of a kill or whatever. It's that I'm on a mission here. You know, I mean, looking back at it a couple years afterwards, I was like, that's what this guy was doing. He's like, I'm just going to continue to do this until I get caught. You know, because to do it that quickly, I mean, again, I don't study the minds of serial murders, but usually it is like a day or two or a couple of days. They spread it out, it seems like. But he just seemed like he was on a mission to kill as many women as he could.
Investigators later identify a rear sliding glass door as the point of entry. There are pry marks along the frame. Rowling enters before Krista Hoyt returns home. Inside, he moves a bookcase from behind the front door into the bedroom, positioning it so he can ambush his victim once she arrives. Hoyt spends the evening playing racquetball with a friend. She returns home around 10 p.m. Crime scene investigators later find her racket and a can of balls near the locked front door. The medical examiner concludes the attack is sudden and overwhelming. Survival brief. Consciousness likely lost almost immediately. After killing her, Rowling stages the scene again.
Not only did he murder them, slaughter is a good term, but then he posed the bodies in sexually suggestive positions. I mean, it was more than just that he was a murderer. He wanted to leave a message.
Later, he realizes he's lost his wallet and he returns to the apartment to search for it. While inside, he further manipulates the body.
He didn't want to be a run-of-the-mill serial murderer. He wanted to be spectacular, and he wanted to shock the people who would find the bodies.
When Rowling returns to his campsite, none of the Gainesville victims have been discovered. The following afternoon, on Sunday, August 26th, at around 3 p.m., the bodies of Christina Powell and Sonia Larson are found.
I watched all this unfold on the news and then was calling my friends up there and was like, what is going on? And they were like, we're freaking out. You know, there's obviously a serial killer on the loose. We're all starting to pair up and stay together in people's apartments and people's dorms. A good guy friend of mine was like, we're trying to find a gun to protect ourselves.
The response is immediate. Police flood the area. News spreads quickly across the campus. Neighbors gather outside the apartment complex.
Parents panicked right away, first when the first set of murders. My news director at the time said to me, go to Gainesville and find out who's responsible for this. And I looked at him, I said, come on, you're kidding me. Everybody in the state, all law enforcement, he said, no, go up there. You're an investigative reporter. You won't have to do daily stories. Just find out. I couldn't dissuade him. So I get up there to Gainesville.
But while the media scrambles, Rowling is there, blending into the crowd, watching.
Yeah, the speculation, and again, was that he would kind of hang out there and watch it all and kind of take in that this is all for me. Again, this is what people were saying at that time, that that's what he was doing, that he wasn't hiding. He was going out in plain sight and standing around, where the media was set up and still going to stores and kind of like taking it all in.
The next night, August 27th, he begins surveilling another apartment. Tracy Paulus, 23 years old, lives there with her roommate, Manny Tabata. Phone records later show Paulus is on the phone until 1 a.m. Tabata leaves work shortly after 1:20, finishing a bartending shift. While Rowling is outside the apartment watching, another discovery is made across town. Police enter Krista Hoyt's apartment and find her body.
You can imagine as the police officer arriving at the scene, walking in on that, the shock of that. That your experience. So that did seem to be a dig at both his father, but then also police in general.
Around 3 a.m., Rowling enters the apartment of Tracy Paulus and Manny Tabata through the rear sliding glass door. A man living in the apartment directly above later reports hearing a scream sometime between 2 and 3 a.m. Inside, Tabata is asleep. Rowling attacks him first. It's sudden, overwhelming. Tabata dies quickly.
The only reason we figured that he was murdered was he had the unfortunate circumstance of being a roommate of Paulus. I don't believe they were in any relationship other than they were friends. They're a roommate, and when he got there and Tabata was there, he murdered him.
Tracy Paulus witnesses the attack and runs into her bedroom, locking the door. Investigative notes later show the door frame is damaged, consistent with it being forced open. What happens next is prolonged. The medical examiner documents extensive sharp force injuries. There's evidence Paulus is restrained. Curtains are taped shut. The apartment is contained. By morning, both Paulus and Tabata are dead. The bodies are discovered the next day.
I moved into the dorm somewhere in mid-August, and then, once school started, and that's when we heard about the murders.
That again is the voice of Laura Azzarello Thompson, who was an 18-year-old student at the University of Florida at the time.
I really had no experience with anything like this ever in my life. We're all 18-year-old girls on a floor. And I can't say that any of us really had much clue as to what was going on. We were just scared.
Running low on money, Rowling breaks into another apartment in Northwest Gainesville on August 30th. While inside, he eats oatmeal, leaves dishes in the sink, watches a Playboy video, and leaves the television on when he departs. Next, he steals the occupant's car and drives to Tampa. He spends the next week committing small robberies. On September 7th, 1990, he robs a Winn-Dixie in Ocala, brandishing a handgun. But robbery has never been Rowling's strength. The store manager follows him out of the shopping center and gives police a detailed description of his location. As Rowling attempts to leave the parking lot, patrol cars are already closing in and he's arrested.
He was a much better serial killer than he was a robber. And so he went back to robbing. He gets caught. And then they go to his tent. He was camping in the woods. And they find evidence that links him to the rapes and the murders. So it was serendipitous that they caught him. Had he not done the robberies, or had he not been camping in the woods with all the evidence, he could have gone on to someplace else.
Police quickly realize Rowling is wanted in Louisiana for the shooting of his father. They locate his campsite near the University of Florida almost immediately. Inside his tent is evidence tying him directly to the Gainesville murders. When I spoke to Mike Deason, he recalled seeing Rowling in person.
He was really unusual. I mean, in some of the court appearances, he started singing. He was in a different world. He was a different type of person that looked like he was trying to be famous. I mean, when you get into a courtroom and he starts singing or doing Elvis songs, that's not typical.
Over the next several years, Rowling gives multiple confessions, lengthy, detailed, and at times contradictory. Eventually, he pleads guilty.
We're in the courtroom, and they're about to begin, and he stands up and he says something like, "I don't want to make this go on any further. I plead guilty." I mean, they were ready to do their opening arguments, and he stood up. I don't even know if his attorney expected him to do that. It was a true shock. But that's Danny Rowling.
Danny Rowling is responsible for what he did. But this episode isn't just about the week in August when he terrorized a college town. It's about what came before. The abuse documented and dismissed. The warnings that reached the chief of police and went nowhere. The pattern of escalation, peeping, burglary, violence, all treated as isolated incidents instead of a trajectory. When he arrives in Florida, Rowling doesn't appear out of nowhere. He's grown up in a house defined by fear. His abuser is protected by a department protecting its own. Inside a system that repeatedly chooses not to intervene. By the time Danny Rowling arrives in Florida, the pattern is already set. Gainesville didn't create Danny Rowling. It encountered him at full escalation. When early violence is ignored, when authority shields itself, when red flags are dismissed as, quote, family matters, the consequences don't stay local. We've seen it before with offenders like Bundy and Warnos, and like them, Danny Rowling is executed by the state of Florida on October 25th, 2006.
There's been so many serial murderers that we've had in Florida, unfortunately. But I have never seen such an intense police manhunt for someone because these were college students at the premier university in the state of Florida.
Trauma travels from one state to another until someone finally pays attention. Before we wrap up, a quick note. Now, Unmarked takes a lot of work to produce. Every episode comes out of weeks and weeks of research and documents and interviews. So we're starting to work with advertisers to help support us. But you can always listen without ads and get early access to episodes inside Unmarked Case Files. And if it's the Manson murders that interest you, my book, Charles Manson, The Last Words, is available on Amazon and Kindle. That book contains interviews I've done with the members of the Manson family for the last decade, including Charles Manson himself. This episode of Unmarked was produced by John Addo and edited by Dave Alderson. Our additional producer is Jesse Demaray. Until next week, this is Unmarked.
Whether it's slots or live dealers, SpinQuest.com has the fun and action you're looking for with SpinQuest exclusives, blackjack, roulette, baccarat, and even live dice with craps and bubble craps. The games never stop, so you don't have to. And right now, new users get $30 coin packs for just $10. Play now at SpinQuest.com.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.